Good morning.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning, it's Cal and Doug.
Hey, Cal.
Hi. We're going to need to be on a different phone this morning. So not as good reception as the other one.
Okay, so we had started the chapter 6 last week, and honestly, it's still hard for me to just, you know, up to this point, I think we've seen a lot of great examples of sequence of why one verse followed another, and I think we really got to the core of a lot of issues. Here it's still a little evasive, although there is, I think we've still got some basic ideas. We had discussed last week about the one primary issue which seems to be, you know, following from the previous thought, where it talks about in 5:18 that God gives a person wealth and possessions and he lets him enjoy it and to take his portion. And this is a gift of God. So there he's talking about something which is positive, where God gives him wealth and possessions. Where in contrast, 6:2 says, is talking about an evil that that King Solomon sees. And he says this happens quite often amongst men. And he describes where again it says that God gives to the person wealth and possessions, but then he adds on honor. And there, the person never gets to satisfy. There's nothing lacking in his soul, he says, from everything he desires, but he does not, the verse says that God doesn't allow him to consume it. And really, from Rashi, it's clear that it's the person himself that it just doesn't get satisfied. He keeps on searching after more. And therefore, he doesn't ever enjoy what he has in the present. And it could be that the little nuance, that word of where he's contrasting it, and he says that here he's talking about the person searches after wealth and possessions and honor. So the first one didn't talk about honor, because I was talking about what's really necessary for a person. A person doesn't need honor. It's not necessary for him. What's necessary is just that he has his possessions and he has his wealth, and he can enjoy it. Here, the person can't. So King Solomon, the initial idea we discussed is that the person has he doesn't have the capacity to enjoy what he has because he's going after more. Okay. And we see also in verse 7, in 6:7, where he talks of, and he says, a man works for his mouth, I guess food, to satisfy what his mouth needs, but his soul is not filled. So you see, he's contrasting mouth to the soul. The aspirations is what is still left like a gaping hole, where the person just doesn't satisfy, he's not satisfied because he's looking in the fantasy. He's not living in the moment, as you would say, or for what he really needs. So the aspirations is what's causing the person's dissatisfaction with life. Even in verse 3, where he talks about what you think a person would want to do once he has all his wealth and he has everything secure, to spend a long time with his children and so on. Here the person is not even, he can't even enjoy that either. So perhaps he's bringing in verse 3 to show you that there's two areas that the person is missing his enjoyment. He doesn't get to enjoy the wealth, And of course, he's talking there where he won't touch it, and somebody else will get it after he dies, according to Swarno. And this is something which bothers him, which really shouldn't, because a person shouldn't have any sense of being upset about that which he doesn't experience. So if after I'm dead, if something happens to my money, that should not be a concern for me right now. That should not bother me now, because if I look at it realistically, that won't affect me at all. That's not going to be something which I have a concern about when I'm dead. But a person does have that type of corrupt thinking in his life now, where he's worried about things that are really completely not going to affect him. The person's worrying now about what's going to happen to his money when he's dead. That's an unhealthy attachment to his money. Because, in fact, it's not going to affect him at all. But you see, the attachment to the money, it hurts a person in many ways. And he says that this is something which is very common amongst people. That's how he opens up chapter 6. And you see, he says in the second verse that he's not lacking anything for all his soul desires. So he's not. Why is he dissatisfied? Why is he unhappy? Because he's going after more than what's really necessary. And his considerations are crooked. Okay. Then he made the comparison to this type of person, and he says that better off is a stillborn. That was the end of 3. And verse 4, 6-4, he says, because in futility does he come to the world, and in darkness does he leave. And in the darkness is his name covered, meaning there's no recollection, there's no mark that this stillborn made. But he also adds on one more thing. He adds on verse 5. Well, let's stop for a second and think about 4. What is his message here? What is his message when he says that the stillborn is better than the person that is completely has a dissatisfied life? And the reasoning he gives is, again, because in futility does he come, and in darkness does he go from the world, and in darkness is his name covered over. So think about that for a moment. Yes, Doug.
If I look at the stillborn, it seems that, as he mentions, he comes in vanity, goes in darkness, his name is covered. It seems that the stillborn never gets any what we might call illumination in the world, never gets a chance to see what's real or what's really true, or in essence, and these are synonymous to that, the whole point of it all. And could it be that he's contrasting that quality with the person in the earlier part of 3? The person who, even if he has 100 kids and he lives many years, and he has a lot of stuff, but his soul, my translation says, will not be sated from all the good. In other words, he doesn't really see what the real good is, the real illumination. So he's just wandering around kind of in the dark, and at the end, what was the difference between that if he'd just been born and immediately died?
Right, so it seems to be, I mean, would you agree also that he's not saying that the total sum of both individuals is the same, meaning the stillborn and the person who had a dissatisfied life? Is he saying the total sum, or is he only saying in a certain capacity the stillborn is better? Meaning, the person who had a dissatisfied life, maybe it's just in as much as his aspirations, his desires for money and for whatever he's chasing after. So there, since there was no satisfaction, so it'd be better off that you didn't have the wasted energy into the, because you didn't end up taking anything. So a stillborn is equal, or maybe better in that respect. He is better, actually, because a stillborn leaves the world with the same thing that this guy who's dissatisfied leaves with, but the stillborn didn't have to exert any energy. So the total sum in that respect, in that isolated component of life, the stillborn wins out, because the stillborn and the dissatisfied person who lives a full life, in both cases, neither one leaves with satisfaction, but at least the stillborn didn't waste any time.
Yes, I agree. I don't think he's equating them as totally synonymous, but you're right. It's kind of a little bit like two guys walked up to a messy warehouse, and one tried to reorganize it, and the other didn't do anything, and at the end, they both found out that the one guy's efforts were a complete waste of time, so the guy who did nothing was really better off than the guy who exerted all the effort for nothing.
Right. So in terms of that effort of reorganizing the warehouse, they were the person who did nothing was better.
Because at least he didn't, you know, waste his time exerting all the effort.
Right.
Rabbi?
Yes.
I have a different problem. What do we mean when we talk about the soul being content? Is that the mind or the emotion?
The soul being content here means the human experience of the, you know, the psychological state of the person. And it says that the soul is not satisfied, you mean?
Yeah.
Right, that was the end of 7, right? Right, so...
Yeah, 3.
End of 3. Right, it says the same thing there, right. And the person's soul is not satisfied. Right.
So that we're referring to a psychological satisfaction.
That's right. Right. That's what we're talking
okay.
about. Because you're talking about the emotions here. That the person should have. He had like hundreds of sons and long years, and he lived a very full life. Meaning to say that which is really what the person is working all this time for. So now it seems to me he's saying, let's get past the point of what is the person's idea of happiness in life. He has all the money and everything, but is it money for the money, or is it the money for the family? So he says, all right, let's see if he actually has a family, great family, and long days that he could live with them, this person as well is still not going to get satisfied with that either, because his aspirations in the area of wealth are not allowing him to do that. So in two areas, it's this predominant type of an emotion, which, you know, King Solomon says right at the beginning, this is a very common thing. The people are ruining their lives, and they're losing satisfaction because they're looking for the next win, the next success. So there, I believe, he's giving the examples, both in the area of wealth and the area of family, meaning what, you know, because I believe, again, he's trying to say there's two areas. Is the one of the wealth, but then what does a person want to do once he has all his wealth? Does he want to retire and enjoy his family? Well, even that he's not doing. So this is in terms of examples. In terms of verse 7, there I think is the rule. Why does he have to add that in there? Why does he have to say again that the soul is not full? Because here I believe he's trying to tell you the rule, the principle, is that all of man is really to what he consumes. And we said this earlier, that in 5:18 it talks about that. That's a portion that God gives a person, where he can consume what he worked on, his portion. Right? The God allows him to rule over and to eat from what his portion is. And he's happy with it. But the person never gets to consume what he put away, and he's always looking for more. So where is the actual enjoyment? How are we designed? So I believe that's the rule. The rule is in 6:7, that all of work of man is to what he consumes, to his mouth. And there can be satisfaction. The person feels good. He's actually enjoying, he's making use of what he labored for. So there's a satisfaction we talked about there. So there, I believe, he's laying down the rule. But he does talk about a few different, wrong notions. Another notion he talks about here is longevity. In 6:6, he says, for if a person would live 2,000 years, but he would never see any good. Is it not that people go to the same place? Doesn't everybody go to the same place? So what is he vocalizing here? What emotion is he vocalizing here?
Utility and despair.
Longevity, meaning if a person lived 2,000 years, or as he puts it, a person lived 1,000 years twice. I mean, he takes the life of the longest aged person, which was an Adam generation. People lived about 1,000 years. So he says, even if you had that and you doubled it, do not all people go to the same place? So what is he bringing this up now for?
Well, okay, maybe I misunderstood. Are you trying to identify the emotion he's feeling or the point he's making?
Both.
Well, it would seem like what he's getting at is the length of time that you have doesn't really matter if you're not focused on the right stuff. So if you are focused on the cleaning the warehouse the wrong way, it doesn't matter whether you spend a week, a month, 2 months, or 6 years at it, still at the end, the point is useless and you have no psychological satisfaction from it. So without the proper, I guess, illumination of the proper focus, the length of time makes no difference, even though the knee-jerk reaction would be, well, of course we'd all want to live twice as long.
Okay. And now let's take it into the emotional framework of the person here. This person is going after wealth. For example, I'll reuse Sforno. So Sforno says as follows. If the person would live 2,000 years, and he did not see any good, so his commentary now commences and says, even if he didn't have a life of pain, what benefit is there in the length of his life? Even if he lived double this many times, but he does not reach any type of eternal hope. Do not all people go to one place? This is the next quote from the verse, and that was commentary. He says, "Is it not to one place, in terms of the levels of loss that a person goes? I believe what he's referring to. Let me see his last sentence over here." It appears what he's saying is that there's an inherent problem with a person's life who's looking for this wealth, this type of a lifestyle, because the person is harboring a sentiment that do not all people go to one place, doesn't everybody die? So what he's trying to tell you is that there is a dissatisfaction, an additional dissatisfaction in this person with the aspirations for wealth, because deep down inside, he senses that it's not going to be eternal. And if something is not eternal, it loses the real satisfaction that the person imagines. See, part of the that's why there's a very big attachment to people who are wealthy to build humongous homes, something which to them is a statement of immortality. And they could spend a lot of time and go through a lot of discomfort living in a small house and the pain of waiting for the house to be built. But this is all because of harboring this feeling of mortality. Everybody else dies, but I'll be here forever. I mean, that again comes because a person is only used to experiencing his life on earth. And that's the mistake that the person makes. He feels that whatever he sees, that whatever is sensory, that rules the mind. That tells him what is true. And since he's here, this all he'll always be here. It's a real denial that a person has. I mean, it's even a statement that he says, that I think it's the next chapter, that God hides the day of death from a person. He says, Gama all nusim belibam. Also the world that God planted man's heart, in order they shouldn't see the end. Okay, we'll see where it is. But evidently there was a necessity for the sense in man that he should have a certain feeling that he's here for a while. He felt he's dying tomorrow, so then people would be mortal. They wouldn't be able to live. So there has to be a certain sense that they will be here for a while. But at the same time, a person has to have the realization that it's not eternal. That's really the tightwire act. That's really where the chachma, the wisdom of a person, has to come in and help the person out. But deep down inside, the person is looking for more and more. There's a dissatisfaction that comes up when sometimes he faces the fact that it's not going to be eternal.
Rabbi, I have a question on that.
Yes.
So I can understand in certain circumstances that a wealthy person might have that fantasy. And we can probably think of some wealthy people in the news who seem to clearly have that. On the other hand, if I took a wealthy person who wanted, they came into, they closed a big business deal and they finally have a huge amount of money, and they're really excited about getting a very cool car. I don't know, something very exotic, a Maserati or Lamborghini or whatever. I'm not so certain that the person has in mind that that car is going to last forever. They're just in a present moment where they want something that they want, which they think will bring them a certain level of pleasure. So I guess I'm questioning whether those who seek after wealth are always thinking of it in terms of an eternal thing.
I believe that they have to. I believe that's the concept behind any pleasure that the person is going after, that if a person fantasizes about something, so fantasy by definition has to have a flawless presentation in the mind. A person can't fantasize about a new car, and in the same fantasy, he's seeing the car getting into an accident and denting up. He can't fantasize about a vacation and it is raining, and in his fantasy he sees images of it's raining the entire time. By definition, the person's desire to get out of the current moment by fantasy and thinking about what can happen, the person is trying to afford himself some pleasure, so he thinks about something. So by definition, it has to be all pleasure. And another part of the fantasy that the person can't tolerate is that the fantasy has an end. If a person had that idea, fantasizing, I'm getting this car, I'm just going to have it for a year or whatever, and then it's going to come to an end, and he embraces that, that takes away all the wind out of his sails. So I believe that element is there, however unconscious it might be, or however inconspicuous it is. It has to be there.
Would we say then that a truly righteous person would never have a desire for a new car or a new house?
His attachment to objects is going to be completely different, because what the righteous person, or the intelligent, I'd rather use the intelligent person, because you have a person who's righteous, he does things properly, doesn't sin, but if his intelligence is lacking, so then he's going to have incorrect attachments, even though he didn't sin. So let's use the term the intelligent person. So the intelligent person is following the system of the Torah. So his attachment to objects, first of all, is going to be much fewer and far between than anybody else's, because what really gives him satisfaction in life is the opportunities that he has to learn, to investigate, to ponder new ideas, to share it with others, because he's definitely an emotional being like everybody else's, so he enjoys that. He enjoys doing good for others. So that's really what he's attached to. Everything else is really just a means to set up that, it's just a backdrop. So the car, the new home, he's going to be happy with a lot less. Of course, he wants to be in a place where he's got heat, he's got water, he's got a bed to sleep on, he's got a table to write his notes, he's got food, he's got clothing, all the basic necessities. But then, you know, after he has all that, where does his attention go to? His attention goes to what he really sees as eternal. He lives daily with the concept that life is a limited amount of time. So he doesn't deny himself enjoyment. So I mean, he'll enjoy a steak, and if he needs something, so there's definitely going to be, you know, he'll gauge himself as he's going. If he needs a new car, so he'll gauge himself and he'll see what can his expenses take care of, and what is really going overboard, what's going too extreme, what's too, you know, extravagant, and what's unnecessary. I mean, he can't say, the Jewish life is not where you live like a monk and you deny what the pleasures are. I mean, God created so many numerous fruits and numerous species of birds and fish that just, you know, create such pleasure when we look at them and, you know, when we taste the fruits or different things that are so scenic. Why? Because pleasure is a necessity for the person. But in terms of what's his relationship to that car, he's not going to need the big ostentatious thing. He's not going to be concerned about what the typical person is, where they have to outdo somebody else, and it's got to be something which, you know, the honor is there, the self is part of it. See, that's why we pointed it out before. The incorrect life is where the person is looking for wealth, possessions, and honor. The correct life is where a person is looking for wealth and possessions. He needs that. Doesn't mean he has to be rich. Wealth means that he has his money. He has ability.
It's a practical life.
Yeah, he's not an ascetic. He's practical. I mean, he doesn't deny himself enjoyments. I mean, he feels sometimes, you know, he needs to take a day off. He's to get in his car, and he's going to drive somewhere, refresh himself, look at some nice scenery. He's curious about certain things. Maybe he'll take a trip and go to a museum, and he'll have a little change that way. Or maybe he hasn't seen a friend in a long time, and that would be good. And he recognizes that. Or maybe whatever the other, you know, his needs are, he gauges it. But he also, his attachment to things are for what they really offer him. He's living in reality. A person who's caught up with fantasy, he's not satisfied because, by definition, fantasy is not real. So if you're making up images in your head of what's going to happen, and the person, you know, chases after honor, he can't wait. Finally, he's getting that dinner where he's now being, you know, the guest of honor. Now, we talked about this once, but then, and he fantasizes about everything, but in this fantasy, does he realize that the dinner is over at a certain point? Does he realize that 2 weeks down the road, nobody even talks about it anymore? No, because in the fantasy, it's eternal. It's something which his mind looks at. This is now, that is to him going to be something which is, everything works out perfectly. I deliver my speech properly. Everybody's applauding and standing for me. Everything that he manufactures in order to have that sense, again, he's looking for the wrong thing to begin with. He wants honor. But then it comes to a screeching halt, and he didn't think about that. So by definition, when a person goes after something which is not what the world offers, so he's going to be very dissatisfied. Like the person is going after the money. So he has certain fantasies about what that money is going to do. But the truth is, he doesn't change internally just because he gets more money. Where is the internal change in his personality that he can really be satisfied? That is not going to give you satisfaction. God did not design a human being that the abundance of wealth gives you satisfaction. That's not the way your person's designed. It's like trying to live just by eating sand. That's not the design of the human being. How is a person going to achieve the happiness? He has to study how the human psyche derive happiness. Where does happiness come from? So that's what Kohelis, as King Solomon, is telling us over here, these numerous chapters. So if a person has he eats when he's hungry, and he's not trying to exert himself too much in work for that which is just a fantasy, but he works because he knows he has to have a place to live and so on, and has clothing, and he's taking care of his family. So now there's a satisfaction that he's providing. There's a self-worth, which is important that the person has, because he's addressing his needs as the breadwinner for his family. So that's a good thing. He feels that good self-image. But ultimately, he understands that the real meaning in life is coming from the highest level of himself, the intelligence. Remember, Rabbi Chait said once that you can show a person what they really value by what bothers them the most. So you can tell a person that he's not a good dresser, or that that he made a mistake in the pronunciation of a word. All right, he could live with that. But tell a person that he's stupid. So now that really bothers the person, because the person senses that the intelligence is really the highest element in the self. And that's the biggest insult to give a person, because it is the part of the person that we pride ourselves on the most. That is what we really feel our our highest element is. What's the real definition of us? So again, the objects of the intelligent person, what they go after is its intelligent plan, and they're not trying to squeeze out of reality something which is a fantasy. They don't look for that, because they realize that it doesn't afford that. So when they enjoy a meal, they enjoy something new, it's for what it really can afford, offer the person. And how does it fit in to my overall view, my worldview, in terms of what's of value in life and what's not going to contribute to that value, the person doesn't really, spend the time with. a typical person, somebody says something bad about them behind their back, they get infuriated. How can you say this about me? So on and so forth. That's because your typical person, the ego is the center. And that's what media caters to in most societies. The intelligent person realizes that the statements of other people do not affect his value and what he enjoys at all. So it's like water off a duck's back. It does not affect him, because his value is not in the social. His value is not in seeking honor, as we saw King Solomon point that over here. He realizes this life is temporary, and there's an eternal component of the person, meaning the soul, and that's something which he realizes is a great gift. And if he cultivates that and he engages more in knowledge, he enjoys it more, and it's appealing. And that's something which, that's the only part that could really last eternally. So why should I forfeit an eternity by chasing after things that are so temporal? In a few decades is nothing. But these are the emotions that King Solomon is vocalizing here. He's showing that this is a very common one. People are chasing after that wealth. But that, again, is all based on the fact that they have a sense of immortality. Because why does a person have to earn more than what he could spend in his life, 80 years or so? It's a foolish thing. It must be because he does not think that he's going to die. He thinks he'll have enough time to spend it all. That has to be what's, promoting those aspirations. Are the questions answered? That the who's it, Francesca? Doug?
Yep.
Thanks, Rabbi.
Yeah, sure.
Hey, Rabbi, I have a question.
Yes.
This phrase, you know, he says that with the stillborn, that its name is covered in darkness. I mean, what does that mean exactly? Is that saying basically, like, that he doesn't have the honor? Or what does that phrase mean?
Yeah, good question. I wanted to come back to that. Okay, let's take that up. Let's take that up now. So he's saying that the stillborn is better off than the person who exerts all this energy and comes away with the same thing. Okay.
And is it germane to the explanation that he adds in verse 3, neither did he have burial, which seems like a really odd thing to get thrown in there?
Yeah, well, that we mentioned Sforno's explanation, that when it says he's like in between. He's so old that he can't enjoy life, but he's not dead yet. He doesn't have burial yet. So he's like a person who had the wrong lifestyle is now stuck in between because he would like to have death because life has become painful. So it's a phenomenon.
Oh, I get it. I get it. I was reading it differently.
Yeah, it's a tough verse. Believe me, I did not get that either until I read the Sforno. It's a difficult verse, but I like what Sforno's saying there. He says he has not died yet, and in this form, meaning in this manner, he's not of the dead. He's not of the living. He's not partaking of either world. But now he just has a length of days that are just painful because they're not really living because he's. He's, I guess, too old, too feeble to enjoy the physical life. But if a person's an individual who pursued wisdom, so he'll have that in his old age too. And he'll have it in the greatest form. Okay.
I don't want to detract from Josh's question, but just as an aside, would you say that a lot of elderly people find themselves in this position?
Yeah, because I think the majority of the world has been living a false lifestyle.
So they get to the end where they can't really enjoy the physical world, but they're still alive and they don't really have anything intellectual to reach for.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, let's see what he says over here. The stillborn is better. Let's see the words again. So he says, in futility does he come, and in darkness does he leave or go, and in darkness is his name covered. So it brings up name also. It seems to be alluding to the fact that the person who did live a full life but with faulty aspirations, that seeking the name was important. And again, that's what verse 2 says. It adds in the word honor, to the person seeking honor. But he loses it too. Who remembers anybody who was alive 100 years ago? This concept of having fame is something which is a fantasy. It's a very powerful fantasy. I'm wondering if in verse 5, where it says that he doesn't, he did not see the sun, I mean, again, the stillborn, and he did not know any pleasure this way or that way. I mean, there wasn't that type of a conflict. He never experienced conflict because he never was alive. So that type of a conflict was not something which the stillborn had to experience. see if we can get to what his point is over here about the darkness. And it seems, you know, just intuitively, meaning without any knowledge. Darkness means that nobody knew about it. Okay, we have a bar. Difficult verse. But we shouldn't be surprised. I mean, Isamu is one of those the greatest thinkers, the wisest individuals. I told you that when he was 12, God miraculously gave him wisdom. So it has to be.
It seems like from the commentary that I'm looking at, that Rashi takes it literally. That this is about a stillborn person.
Yes. But that's how we were understanding it too. Rashi says that he had the desires and therefore did not have to have any pain. He had no suffering of not being able to reach his aspirations.
Well, and there's one commentary that explains it as the stillborn of a harlot. And so he didn't see the sun, nor did he know it, would mean that he never woke from life enough to even experience the physical world.
Why does he bring in the fact
that,
why does he bring in a stillborn of a harlot? What does that add to it?
I don't know. It seems like a stretch to me. The commentary says, Radal explains the name of Rabbi Moshe, the preacher of Shklov, that it means the stillborn of an adulteress who is ashamed of her pregnancy and casts away the body at night. Even such a stillborn child is better than the man mentioned above.
Yeah.
At the end of verse 5,
yep.
When it says, has more gratification than that one, it clear to you which is which? What factually in terms of what the verse is referring to?
Let's see. Going to the Targum, according to Oculus, he wants to say that it did not have the illumination of Torah. And it did not know between good and evil to distinguish between this world and the next world. Implying that this is a similar problem that that we've been saying. That people, this evil is happening under the sun. Under the sun means that the evil is that the people are going in this lifestyle are basing it, because there's a number of emotions that are promoting this type of lifestyle. Immortality emotion, which means to say that the physical is everything, and that's what's going to promote the desire for the wealth and to have a lot. So what he's doing is he slowly unravels the different strata of emotions at different points, because there are so many notions that are just no one question. I mean, self-reflection is not something which is, you know, discussed at all in any society today. But King Solomon, having great depth of knowledge and, again, miraculously received from God, he's able to get right to the point to show there's a number of things that are causing, that are propelling a person to certain areas. Now, once you know what they are, you can deal with them. That's the point of exposing the emotions. Now question them. Is this really something to go with when you see yourself chasing, you know, a certain pursuit in life? So stop now. Where is it coming from? Did you evaluate? You know, have you evaluated the pursuit? Have you looked into yourself to see what is propelling me to do this. Maybe there's an unchecked assumption that I have, and if I did stop to think about it, I'd realize that this is false, and I just wouldn't desire it anymore, and it would give me so much more energy to put into what's real and what's true. But I think the point, again, of the stillborn is that you didn't suffer through all this anguish. And of course, a stillborn is not better than the person who lives the right life. It's comparing it to the person who's living this lifestyle. Because they're both leaving with the same thing. But one exerted decades of energy and ended up with the same thing that the stillborn ends with. But that's again, supports the idea that he's only talking about the assessment of life based on just the earthly portion. So if you're just going to look at the earthly portion, so then the stillborn is better off. But of course, it's not talking about the true idea is that, of course, there's the eternal life that a person can have. So the stillborn can't be compared to that, of course. But it's only comes into the picture if, you know, King Solomon is working within the framework of these people, the people that are just living based on a life that begins and ends under the sun. So if that's where your evaluation is, so it shows even in your system, you're losing out. Maybe he brings up the fact that it's in darkness that he goes, and darkness is his name covered because, and he's nonetheless he's still saying he's better off. That means that the completely ignorant, stillborn, surpasses the fool. So what's the lesson we get from all this? Is that we have to constantly be on guard to test what is real, what is really something which contributes to true happiness, and what is just a fleeting thought, a fantasy, something which is not going to materialize. It's interesting. Something caught my eye yesterday. I was reading there's a portion of the prophets that we read after the reading of the Torah in the temple on Shabbos. And the portion we were reading was Malachi, chapter 3. And in there, it talked about how people were saying that what benefit is it that we follow God and that we go humbly before Him. And they even praise the wicked people that are successful. So God says in the future is eventually going to show the difference between good and evil. Meaning the people that have the question now, eventually this answer will, it seems to be from the reading of the prophets that, again, it seems to me also that there are two groups of people that was talking about it. Let me just read it to you. But, a second. It's so important. You have to pay such clear attention to the words. Again, because it's all divinely inspired. So there's tremendous depth and accuracy and precision. Every single word. Let's see, here we go. So God says in 3:13 in Malachi that your words are heavy upon me. And you say, what have we spoken on you? So God says back, you've said vanities. Excuse me, you've said it is vain to worship God. And what benefit is there that we keep his Mishmarto, meaning his Torah, and that we should walk humbly before him. That we should be subjugated before God. And now, we praise the wicked. We also build up those who do evil. All those who test God, and they escape. So these are the words of the Jews that were making a wrong assessment. And what God is saying, that your words were heavy upon me. But then it tells you a narrative of a few people who were talking to each other amongst listening to their Jewish brethren, you know, criticize God and the system. It says, then there spoke those who fear God, one man to his friend, and God inclined his ear and he heard them, and he wrote down into a book of remembrance before him regarding those who fear God and those who ponder his name. So then God, so he writes down, that means to say that there's a merit to those people that listened, and then they discussed the matter. They heard people talking about how people are escaped, that there are, you know, people that are doing, you know, that they're living great lives here on earth, despite the fact that they're breaking the Torah in every which way. And God says these words are hard upon him. They're heavy. But then there were a few Jews that listened, and they discussed the matter amongst themselves, and then God recorded them, right? It's interesting, in verse 16, it says, then there spoke those who fear God, one man to his friend. So you see there, it talks about people who fear God. Then it says that God inclined his ear, and he heard, and he wrote down in the book of remembrance. Now, who did he write down? He wrote down the names of these people who fear God, but then this is one more thing. Those who ponder his name. It sounds like the verse is subtly telling you that there's another group of Jews that God is recording as being meritorious. But who were the ones that were discussing the matter once they heard their fellow Jews criticizing God? It was a group called those who fear God. So those are the ones that had to discuss this matter. So God, but God writes down in this book two groups, it appears to me. Those who fear God, but then those who ponder his name. Right. So, and Ibn Ezra seems to follow this. He says, then there spoke those who fear God, meaning those are the wise, they're understanding. Those are the righteous ones. Right? Those are the righteous ones. But those who ponder his name, those are the wise of heart that know the fundamental secrets, the fundamental principles that are honorable and glorious. So it seems to be that he's making a distinction between those who fear God, the righteous people. And we talked about that earlier. Doug had a question that a person is righteous and he lives a certain life, and I wanted to just clarify a difference between a righteous person and a person who is a real intelligent person. A person is righteous means he's following the system actively. He's keeping the mitzvahs. But that doesn't mean he's somebody who ponders God's name. That's what I believe what God is about to say, is that only one group had a question over here. When they heard the Jewish brethren making a statement of Well, why is it beneficial to follow God? Look at all these rich people. Well, not rich. Look at all these evil people. And those who do, those who perform sin. They do wickedness. And they test God. And they escape. They don't have bad lives. They have great lives. So when these first group of ignorant Jews were talking in that way, a second group of Jews heard it. And they spoke, and they just had to discuss the matter. What does discussing the matter mean? Evidently, they didn't have the answers. So they had to discuss. But when God writes down a merit to those people, he writes them down in his book of remembrance, but then he also writes down the people who ponder his name. Pondering God's name means to say there's another group of Jews that they're not the yirei, they're not the ones who just fear God. Fearing God is not the ultimate level. Loving God is the ultimate level. So what's the difference between one who fears God and one who loves God? So one who fears God, he doesn't want to break his system. He's righteous. He performs everything. But that's not the highest level. Because just because you have the fear, it does not mean that you really understand the most fundamental principles that you can. That's why it says another group here. It says those who ponder God's name, God also wrote down. But the people who ponder God's name did not have to discuss this matter, meaning they already had the answer. You see? Just from the verse itself. It's amazing. Okay, so then God says further in 3:17 in Malachi, he says, "Voyuli Amarshem." So those will be to me, says God, on the day where I bring salvation, and I'll have mercy, like a man has mercy on a son who worships him. And you will return, and you will see the difference between the righteous and the wicked, between one who worships God to one who doesn't worship God. Because a day comes that will burn like an oven, and all those that are wicked, and all those that perform sin and wickedness, they'll be like dry, they'll be like straw, and they'll be ignited on that day that will come. It says God, Master of Hosts. And there will not be left a root or a branch of those wicked people. They'll be consumed by the fire of that day. And again, this is all a metaphor here. What does that mean? How are people going to be like straw? And then he says further in 20, and there will shine for them, for those who fear my name, a sun of charity with healing in its wings. You notice again, what is shining? There is going to be something shining for those, but which group? Those who fear my name, meaning this is going to be illumination of some sort. That's what he said earlier, that you'll see that day, you'll see the difference between righteous and evil. Evidently, that the people that fear God, it wasn't a love of God yet because they were lacking real knowledge. Had they had real knowledge, like the group called those who ponder God's name, then they wouldn't have had to discuss the matter, and they would have had the answers. But evidently, this group is not going to get the answers until the future. I mean, in the days of the Messiah, there's going to be illumination, where all the wicked are going to be consumed. What does it mean? That they're going to be ignited like flames? No. It means that their philosophy will be completely destroyed, just like dried out straw is going to be totally consumed, and there won't be a root or a branch left anymore of that philosophy of the wicked people. But evidently, that is only for the people, like it says in the verse, those who fear my name need to have that illumination in the future. But who does not need to have that illumination? It's those who ponder God's name, those who think into matters and have the principles already. So the truth is not something which is hidden until the Messianic era. Maybe for the majority of people, maybe for a lot of people, even the people that defile the Torah to fear. But there are individuals that are considered those who ponder God's name that have thought into the matter now, and that's something which they have currently. They don't need that. The healing is not going to be for those people. The healing, the verse says, is only for those who fear God. So since they're functioning out of a fear, but not out of an intellectual recognition of the deep principles of how God works, so since they function out of fear, they don't have the answer. They had to discuss it, and God will inform them in the future. Yeah, and then the wicked are going to be like under the feet of the righteous on that day, meaning that they'll be totally overtaken by truth. And then he concludes and he says, "Remember the Torah of Moses, my servant, that I commanded him in Horeb, in Sinai, and all of Israel, the statutes and laws, And I will soon send you Elijah the prophet before that great and awesome day. And I will return the hearts of fathers on their children and the hearts of the sons on their fathers, lest I come and smite the whole land. All right, but the thing I wanted to bring up over here is that this again is, we read this yesterday because it mentions, you could say because it mentions Elijah, and we talk about Elijah. There's a reference to it in Haggadah, in Passover, so this is the Sabbath before Passover starts. And so it's also referring to future redemption, and you know, Passover, of course, is dealing with the first redemption. So we always read the Haftorah that has, again, the section of the prophets that has something to do with that day. But it's a very interesting thing that you see that certain knowledge, if you look right at the verses, you see the knowledge is only something which has to be given to those that don't approach the Torah out of a real pondering, a real attachment to seeing the ideas. If the people do that, and they are people that ponder God's name, as they refer to here, they will not have that need for illumination in the future. So it's right there in the verses. I mean, that's we really have to, and this again is what gives us, this is really the very act of pondering God's name, what we're doing here. We're looking at his articulated words in his Torah. And from these very articulations, we see nuances, we see things out of place, purposely, to catch our attention. And we see clearly that God's talking about two different groups. Twice, God is referring to only those who fear him, because they're the ones that need to have it, they have to be addressed on something that they're lacking. Right, does everybody see that? But what that tells you clearly is that there's a need for that illumination in the future, because people are just not doing that now. That's just not where people are attracted to, and that goes back to what we were discussing all day today, is the fact that people have these aspirations that are unchecked based on their sense of immortality, and that's why they're going after wealth, because they're just looking at life as being physical, under the sun. That's all they know. So that's all they really think is real. Doesn't seem kind of what?
I mean, it's like the group of people that fear God and follow the system, wouldn't that include pondering God when they learn the system?
Well, perhaps they're not really studying it. Perhaps they fear it, they see the truth of Sinai, they recognize it, and they're living out of a fear. There's different ways, there's different capacities in the person. So, you could definitely have many people that are just functioning out of a lesser level, more of an emotional base, a fear, the authority factor. They haven't yet reached the point where they're attached to the system based on the highest level of man, his intelligence and the awe of the wisdom that he sees. He's not. They're not yet at that point. Maybe their teachers have failed them. Maybe their parents have failed them. But you could definitely be, a person at a certain point on the path to perfection. And fear is definitely going to be one of the steps. I mean, it's a command too. But the command has to be approached intelligently. You can talk about the fear of God just being like in awe, amazed at what it really means. What does it mean that there's a God? What does that mean to us? What's his capacity to create a universe. The that's fear. That's something which a person is just awed at. King David spoke about that. He says, "When I see the work of your fingers in the heavens." And so it's amazing. What is man that you should be mindful of him? We're nothing compared to that. That's like the awe, the fear.
That's fear.
Yeah, that would be a good definition of fear. I don't think the fear that God really wants is that a person is walking around functioning out of, you know, lightning bolts going to come down and strike me dead if I do this or I do that. That's not a healthy fear. Then is he functioning out of truth, out of attachment? No, he's functioning out of an infantile state of, you know, he wants his life. He doesn't want to be smacked. It's like a child. A person should definitely have fear of punishment, but for the right reason. He should realize that that punishment means that he could really be hurting his soul. It affects him eternally. Just being physically dead, that's not a right assessment of the real values. The real value is that a person can have an eternity where he's attached to truth. And to forfeit that and not to want to have that enjoyment, and that should be what a person is concerned about.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Rabbi, may I say something?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know. The lady that was asking the question about why people don't, I don't know her name. Who was that? Was that the...
Francesca.
Was that Cal speaking or was Francesca?
Francesca,
you know, you were saying something that is so true, and I just wanted to say something because that's very close to my heart also. I wonder why, I don't know how you feel, how I feel naturally, but, you know, sometimes you say to yourself, something is so clear to you, how is it somebody else doesn't see it the same way? When you look at somebody who doesn't have a leg, and you have your two legs, and you say to yourself, I'm so lucky, I'm so fortunate. But most people, we don't see that. Most people don't recognize these things. Most people are going about their business trying to survive. Trying to survive is basically what everybody is doing. I saw a greeting card one time where it says, the three things I do every day, I get up, I survive, and I go to sleep. And this is what basically the people are doing. Everything is a mad rush to try to survive because it's really basically a very fast world. And if you don't keep up with the pace that people are in, and you're in that pace, you can get gobbled up and you won't get your opportunities. But if you take the time, that's why Shabbos is so important. If you take the time to set yourself back away from the crowd, so to speak, and look into some of the books, and there's so many in English that I have found also, and I just love the idea that I have so much to be grateful for, but it's so hard to keep in touch with it because the world doesn't function that way. It's like a merry-go-round, and it makes you dizzy. So I just hope that you have the strength to find people who can think like you do, so you can commiserate. And these classes are so important because it gives you that strength, and it gives you people camaraderie, that you're not alone. And we sort of bounce off each other and learn from each other. As little as we know, we're still learning from each other. And it's wonderful. So I don't know if that means anything to you, but it does to me.
Thank you, Rosa.
Yeah, you're welcome, sweetheart. You're welcome. It's very simple for, you know, for me to say things, but we all have to find it ourselves. That's the big job. We need a lot of help and a lot of, I'm trying to think of the right word. The rabbi said it before, the inspiration, but you have to have the motivation to go follow up. And thank you, Rabbi, because you are here for us, because we have something to work with then and something to follow when we're not having the class.
My pleasure.
Okay.
Any questions or comments? I guess we should be wrapping it up now.
I think we're good.
Okay. As I think we won't be meeting next week. We'll pick up in 2 weeks. All right, so we'll pick up from where we are. If there's any change in plans, I'll let you know. But for now, this next Sunday comes up to be the day before the last days of Passover. So I'm not sure where I'll be. Well, I'll be at that point anyway. So let's just pick it up 2 weeks from today, all right?
Beautiful. Thank you. So
that
would be April 11th.
Okay.
On the calendar.
So
2 weeks from today.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rabbi. Happy Passover to everybody. May this be blessed.
Happy Passover to everybody.
One above, who is the only one who gives us blessings. Thank you so much, Rabbi. Be
You're
well. Bye-bye, everybody.
Thanks. Happy Passover.
Okay, thank you. Have a good week, everybody. Good 2 weeks, actually.
You too.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay.